Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Some Die Young by William W. Johnston and J. A. Johnstone, narrated by Joshua Saxon. Chapter 1. Paul, 13-year-old Tommy, called out to his father, who was up in the hayloft throwing down some hay for the milk cow. "Somebody's coming up the path to the house leading a pack horse." Warren Bannock straightened up and leaned on his pitchfork while he looked in the direction Tommy was pointing. "Yeah, I see him," he answered. "And right at dinner time as usual," he muttered to himself. It was the time of year when the occasional drifter happened upon the path up to his house. Usually it was a cowhand riding a grub line after the herds had been driven to the railroad and he was no longer needed. And Warren would have to explain that he was a one-man farm and not another cattle ranch. It usually ended up with the drifter getting a meal before moving on. "This one looks like a big fella," he thought. "I hope Kitty can scare up enough to feed him." He sighed and went back down the ladder and walked out of the barn to meet the rider. Maybe he's not a cowhand, he thought as he got a little closer. He was leading a pack horse that looked to be loaded heavily, and that was not typical for a cowhand seeking work. As the rider approached the barn, he appeared to be looking all around him as if trying to picture the entire homestead. Warren watched him carefully, thinking how he might have felt better if he was wearing his gun. The rider pulled the buckskin to a stop only a few yards short of him when Warren was suddenly struck with the realization. "John?" "Howdy, Warren." He stepped down from his horse and nodded to the young boy standing next to his father. "Tommy?" Tommy nodded vigorously, still in awe of the big stranger. "John?" Still amazed by the transformation of his younger brother into the imposing stranger facing him, Warren was rendered speechless for a few moments more before he decided it was really happening. "John?" He asked again to be sure when his brother stepped forward to shake his hand. "Tommy, run to the house and tell your mama that John's come home." Without a sound and eyes as big as saucers, the boy turned and ran to the house, only to reappear within seconds, followed by his brother and mother.
"John?"
Kitty Bannock questioned as she ran from the house, still wiping her hands on her apron, also amazed by the rugged individual watching her approach.
"What? How did you get?"
She didn't know what to ask. "Howdy, Kitty," John said. "You mean, what am I doing out of prison?" "It's a long story, but I can honestly tell you that I did not escape from prison. I was pardoned by the governor himself, and before I move on, I thought I'd see how you folks are doing. And you might hear some wild stories about me, so I want to make sure you know the truth. I apologize for popping in on you so sudden this close to dinner time, but I brought some fresh meat with me to cook. I shot a deer this morning, so I butchered it right away. Otherwise, I would have gotten here earlier to give you a little more notice." He was aware that he must have changed drastically since they last saw him, judging by the four faces staring at him.
"It's a good thing you brought a deer with you," Kitty finally spoke, "because I don't think I cooked enough to feed you."
She thought about giving him a welcome home hug, but decided to offer her hand instead. "Let me unload my horses and take care of them, and we'll get some of this venison on the stove," John said. "Or maybe we can build a fire outside and roast it. We're going to want to smoke most of it to eat later, because it ain't going to be fresh after tonight. As big as these two boys are, they're going to need plenty of meat." He nodded toward Billy and Tommy. It didn't take long for his brother and his family to realize that it was indeed still John inside the prison-hardened body that returned home more than 5 years after leaving. He told them how he came to be pardoned after saving the life of a judge. He also told them of the possibility that it might be overturned if another judge had his way, so they understood why he hadn't come to stay. He was happy to see that the farm was doing well and the boys were old enough to help maintain it. He felt he could leave again with a satisfied feeling that his brother's family was doing well and he was not needed. In fact, if he stayed, he might make his brother's situation difficult again, just like it was when he originally left to go to prison. "I hope you'll forgive the surprise visit, even if it is right at dinner time. You reckon we could get Tommy and Billy to gather some wood for a fire?"
"Yes, sir," Tommy responded. "Come on, Billy."
They ran to the woodpile behind the house to bust up some logs.
"You still got that spit in the barn?" John asked his brother.
"Yeah, we still have it," Warren said. "We might have to burn some rust off of it, though. We ain't used it in a long time." Kitty watched Warren's reaction closely. She was well aware of the flood of guilt released into her husband's mind upon the return of his younger brother. It had taken Warren over a year to finally remove those feelings of guilt from his everyday thoughts. She gazed at the powerfully built man now as he untied the fresh meat wrapped in the deer hide and removed it from his pack horse. Then he and Warren took John's horses to the barn. They came back with the crude spit they had fashioned, using the metal axles and wheel rims from an old handcart. Warren was right when he said they had not used it recently. In fact, they had not used it since John went to prison. She found it hard now to envision the 18-year-old young man who had gone to prison for a crime he did not commit. She switched her gaze to her two sons eagerly awaiting the feast of deer meat roasted over an open flame, obviously impressed by their mysterious Uncle John. She decided then that she was glad John was not home to stay. She wanted that admiring look on her sons' faces to be cast in their father's direction. She immediately felt guilty for thinking it when she then thought of the terrible sacrifice John had made to keep her family intact. How could she not be eternally grateful? Kitty was not the only one reading the faces of her family as they tended the roasting meat. Like his sister-in-law, John Bannock was studying her family's reactions to his sudden visit. He was especially observing Kitty's expressions, and he thought he could read the deep concern in her face when she looked at her husband. He decided that it might have been better not to have come back, but it was too late for that decision. At least he had told them he would be leaving in the morning, in spite of Warren's urging him to stay a while longer. When the meat was roasted to their satisfaction, they took it off the spit and carried it into the house. Warren sliced it into portions while Kitty brought the side dishes she had already prepared for dinner and placed them on the table. They decided the meat was fresh enough to cook some more for supper and smoke what was left for jerky. "You know, John," Warren commented, "you could just stay on here with us. I hope you know you've always got a home here. I know the boys will be glad to give you your old room back." John glanced at once toward Kitty to see the immediate frown that appeared on her brow. "Well, now that's mighty nice of you, Warren," he said, "but there's some parts of Texas I got a hankering to see. I reckon that's something prison does to a man. After being locked up in a tiny space for a long time, you get a need to wander." He looked at his sister-in-law. "You can understand that, can't you, Kitty?"
"Oh, indeed I can," she replied. "I don't blame you one bit."
"Besides," John continued, "I wouldn't want to run the boys out of their room. I won't even do that for one night. I plan to bed down in the hayloft tonight." When Kitty started to protest, John went on, "It's what I'm used to anyway. The whole time I was working for Judge Justice, I was sleeping in his hayloft. I got to where I preferred it to sleeping in the house." She met his gaze with a smile.
"You're serious, aren't you? The judge made you sleep in the barn with the horses and cow?"
"He didn't make me sleep in the barn," John insisted. "He was going to make room for me in the house. He was one of the most considerate men I ever met. But I preferred to sleep up in the hayloft. I got more room there."
"He's almost as big as a horse," Tommy remarked. "Watch your mouth," Kitty scolded. "You better show a little more respect for your uncle."
John and Warren both laughed. "He's right, hon," Warren said. "Uncle John sort of grew up when he went to prison, didn't he, boys?" "I don't know how it happened when I think of the food I got in prison, though," John gaped. "That's one reason why I can't come back here. I'm afraid I'd get so big eating your mama's cooking that pretty soon you'd have to haul me around in the wagon."
"Or hit you up to it," Billy commented, "and you'd haul us around in it."
"I declare," John said, pretending to be insulted. "You gonna let those boys talk to me like that?" The horseplay went on for a little while, causing Kitty to remember good times the family had before the tragedy that sent John off to the Huntsville unit of the Texas State Prison. Even Warren was chuckling, showing her glimpses of his old persona instead of the almost constant remorse. She wished it would always be like this, while at the same time knowing that it was really not possible. John had told them of the very real possibility that he would become a wanted man if Judge Raymond Grant had his way, and he had no intention of returning to prison. In view of that, she was determined to enjoy her brother-in-law's brief visit. After the long dinner hour finally ended, Warren and John cut the rest of the deer up in strips to smoke cure over a smoldering fire some green limbs and leaves. They left Billy and Tommy to keep the fire going while Kitty cleaned up the dinner dishes and decided what to prepare for supper to go with the remainder of the fresh meat. Then Warren took John for a little tour of the farm to show him the progress made while he was away. John was impressed. "You've done a hell of a job, Warren, you and the boys." Warren took him down near the river and showed him an acre-sized piece of land adjoining his farm that he was in the process of negotiating with the owner of the property to buy. "Those two boys remind me of you, little brother," Warren said. "They're growing into men pretty damn fast. I'm hoping we can keep expanding the farm so it'll support both of them, if they have their own families one day."
"Big brother," John said, "that is sure enough what I hoped you would tell me when I came here today. I'm satisfied that everything has turned out fine for the both of us. The only thing I want now is for you to make peace with the past and rejoice in the fact that it all happened for the best. They took a walk around the piece of land that Warren was planning to buy, and he told John of his intention to turn it into a cotton field. John responded with enthusiasm for Warren's plans, although farming no longer held any interest for him. He decided then that he had made a good decision when he came back to the farm to visit Warren and Kitty. He now knew for sure that this was not the place he wanted to spend the rest of his life. When they returned to the house after a walk of the entire farm, they found the boys still tending the fire, smoking the venison. "I expect you'd best take the biggest portion of that jerky with you if you're going to be traveling like you said," Warren suggested. "I'll just take a little of it for when I can't find something to hunt," John said. "Where are you going?" Warren asked. "You never said." John shrugged. "West," he answered, then added, "toward Stephenville, I reckon, toward cow country." "You want to work with cattle?" Warren was surprised. Neither he nor his brother had shown any interest in raising cattle before. "I guess so," John replied. He was not sure of it himself. It was just something he thought he could do if nothing better turned up. "I know, I just feel at home on a horse." "Well, when you get your fill of chasing a bunch of ornery old cows around, you can come on back to this little farm and we'll raise cotton and corn and beans." "Looks to me like you got all the help you need to run this place," John said, nodding toward Tommy and Billy at the woodpile, chopping more wood for the meat still smoking. "It's about time to roast the rest of that meat for supper," John remarked. "I'd like to clean up a little before we eat, scrape some of these whiskers off my face, too. You and the boys still go to the river to take a bath?" "Sure do," Warren replied. "Kitty would probably appreciate it if I was to take one myself." When Warren announced to Kitty that he and John were going to the river to take a bath, she responded as if it was the best idea they'd ever had. "Why don't you take the boys with you?" she'd suggested. "I swear," Warren replied, "you'd think we ain't ever took a bath before." "I didn't say you haven't ever taken a bath before," Kitty came back. "It's just the first time it was your idea." "She's got you there, Pa," Tommy said. "But me and Billy go swimming in the river almost every day this time of year." So the Bannock men walked down to the river to take a bath. John took his saddlebags with him with his extra shirt and his razor. After he shucked his dirty shirt, he soaped it up and washed it, then hung it on a bush while he cleaned himself up. He was shaving with a razor and hand mirror when he became aware of young Billy staring at him, so he playfully flicked some water at him. "What are those holes on you?" Billy asked, and pointed at the old bullet wounds in his chest and sighed. Hearing Billy's question, Warren looked at John as well, just then noticing what had attracted Billy's attention. If he had to guess, he would figure they were bullet holes, so he waited to hear John's answer. "Just a couple of places I got poked with tree branches riding through some thick timber," John answered Billy. Warren realized that there was much about the time John was away that he had not shared with them. He couldn't help commenting, "They look like bullet holes." "Yeah, I guess they do at that," John replied, leaving the comment hanging there. "That's because that's what they are, right?" Warren insisted. "Damn it, John, I'm your brother. Tell me what happened." John turned and looked him in the eye while deciding whether or not to explain. Finally, he said, "The one on my side was meant for somebody else. I just happened to get in the way. The one in my chest was meant for me, and the shooter's dead now." End of story. Warren nodded in response, knowing that was all the explanation he was going to get. When he saw Billy about to ask John another question, he shook his head at him. He knew then that there was a lot more about his brother that he was not anxious to share, so he refrained from pursuing it. They finished their swim in the river and returned to the house to find Kitty roasting the last of the venison on the spit. "Good," she said when they arrived. "You can take over the roasting. I've got things in the kitchen to finish." Supper that night was a repeat of the cheerful affair that dinner had been, with both Warren and John recalling humorous incidents involving each other back before John left the farm. After supper, the grown-ups talked late that night, with much of the conversation concerning where John was going when he left them. He tried to explain that there was little he could tell them because he wasn't sure himself. "Just west," he said. "I'll know when I get there." Chapter 2 He was awakened the next morning by the sound of Billy in the barn below him scolding the chickens for their lack of production. Having forgotten that his Uncle John was sleeping in the hayloft above him, Billy was informing the lazy hens of their disappointing lack of effort. And he was using some rather colorful adjectives in describing their performance on an occasion when there was a special guest for breakfast. John pulled his boots on and rolled up his bedroll. He strapped on his gun belt, then went to the ladder and dropped his saddlebags down to the barn below. They landed with a solid thump.
"Morning," John said as he slid down the ladder to land behind a startled Billy in time to grab the egg basket he almost dropped when he jumped.
"Son of a bitch," Billy blurted before he could catch himself. "I forgot you was going to sleep in the hayloft."
"Sorry I startled you," John said. "Is your pa up?"
"He's getting up," Billy answered. "Ma's cooking breakfast, and she needs these eggs."
"And we better take him in the house," John said, and led him out the front door of the barn. When they walked into the kitchen, Warren was sitting at the table drinking coffee.
"Good morning," Kitty said, working at the stove. "Pour yourself a cup of coffee, and I'll have you some breakfast in a few minutes."
She slid a tray of cornbread into the oven.
"You still planning to leave us this morning?"
"Yep, I figured I'd give you the pleasure of my company for breakfast, and then I'll hit the road."
"Still aiming to head up toward Stephenville?" Warren asked.
"Yep," John answered. He didn't confess that he was going that way only because he knew where the road to Stephenville was, and it seemed to be heading in the right general direction. Maybe things might have changed since he was in prison, but there used to be some small cattle ranches in that area. At the present time, catching on at a cattle ranch was his only prospect. He had a little money to carry him for a while, since he had saved every cent he could of the salary Judge Wick paid him, but he hoped he could pick up some wages somewhere.
"I don't understand," Kitty said. "Why are you going to Stephenville?"
"I ain't going to Stephenville," John tried to explain again. "It's just a town on the way I'm heading. Like I said last night, I'll know where I'm going when I get there."
"I don't see why you don't just stay here until you do know where you want to go," Kitty insisted. She was satisfied that he didn't plan to stay with them permanently, but she didn't understand why he was in such a hurry to leave.
He found himself running out of patience, and when he glanced at the grinning face of his brother, it only added to his discomfort.
"Because," he told her, "there's a very good chance that Judge Raymond Grant will have his way, and I'll be a wanted outlaw overnight. And this is the first place they'll come looking for me, so I damn sure don't want to be here when they do."
She shrugged and made a face. "I see your point," she said as she placed his breakfast on the table.
"You're going to have to settle for bacon this morning unless you want deer jerky with your eggs."
He lingered over breakfast longer than he had originally intended, but he wasn't sure how long it would be when he might see his family again, if ever. It was close to mid-morning when he finally struck the road to Stephenville, a small settlement almost 100 miles away. There was a sense of sadness about leaving Warren, Kitty, and the boys again, but there was also a feeling of freedom as he struck out to the west. After 3.5 days of uneventful travel, he rode into the little town of Stephenville at noontime on the fourth day. Ready to spend a little of his money for a decent dinner, he rode the length of the short main street, hoping to find a hotel or a cafe, but there was none. There were 2 saloons, however, and he wondered if one of them might serve meals. He saw that there was a sheriff's office, so he figured that would be a good place to ask. It struck him as ironic that he would ask the sheriff, but he felt very little risk that he was a wanted man. Yet. Deputy Jerry Stubbs looked up from his desk when the door of the sheriff's office was suddenly filled with the intimidating figure of John Bannock. A slight young man, Stubbs was not sure if he was in trouble or not. He pushed his chair back, almost tipping it over in his haste to get to his feet, only to find himself still straining to look the somber stranger in the eye.
"You looking for the sheriff?" Stubbs squeaked.
"Not particularly," Bannock replied. "I'm just passing through town. Never been to Stephenville before, and I thought this would be a good place to ask if there's a decent place to get a good meal." When Stubbs didn't respond at first, other than a not-so-subtle sigh of relief, Bannock asked, "Are you the sheriff?"
"No, sir, I'm not. I'm Deputy Sheriff Jerry Stubbs. There ain't no sheriff, and I'm trying to kind of watch over things since Sheriff Boswell left. As far as a place to get some dinner, the place to go is the Oasis Saloon. They've got a good cook there, and that's where most folks eat."
"Much obliged," Bannock said. "I'll go see what they're cooking today."
"Chicken and dumplings," Stubbs said. "I just came from there not 5 minutes ago. That's what Pearl cooked up today, and they were mighty good."
"I'd still have been there if Ace Parker and 2 more of that crew from the Bar W hadn't come in the saloon," he thought. "They like to aggravate a man wearing a badge, so there weren't no use in me giving them the chance."
Bannock walked out of the sheriff's office and looked down the street to spot the Oasis, only a little way down on the other side. He led his horses over and tied them at the rail with 3 other horses. As a precaution, he pulled his rifle out of the saddle scabbard, not willing to risk the rifle leaving while he was inside eating. Mo Price, the bartender, glanced up to see the solemn-looking stranger push through the batwing doors, and his first thought was, "Here comes trouble."
Unfortunately, this was often the first impression for most people upon meeting the peaceful man from Waco. So Mo studied him carefully as he approached the bar. "What'll it be, stranger?" Mo asked. "Howdy," Bannock offered. "Deputy over at the jail said I could buy some dinner here."
"You sure can," Mo declared in relief. "We got a fine cook and a special section for folks who just want to eat. We do a good business with the local folks who want to get a good meal while they're in town."
He pointed toward the back of the saloon.
"See those four tables in the back corner? They're reserved for our food business. There's even a back door to the outside for folks that don't want to walk through the saloon. There's a customer who came in the back door eating dinner right now. See that young woman and her little boy? That's Emily Green. Her daddy owns a Rockin' G Ranch."
"I don't like to leave my rifle on my saddle when I can't keep an eye on it," Bannock said, "so I brought it in with me. Some saloons don't like you to bring a rifle in. You want me to let you keep it behind the bar till I leave?"
"No, we don't have no rule against toting guns in here," Mo said. "Them three fellers right over there wearing guns."
Bannock turned and saw three men who looked like cowhands get up from a table in the saloon and walk back to one of the four tables Mo had pointed out. They stared brazenly at the young woman.
"It's been a long time since I've had a drink of whiskey," Bannock decided. "I think I'll have one drink before I eat." "What's your pleasure?" Mo asked.
"Just whatever you're pouring will be all right," Bannock answered. "I ain't much of a drinker." He watched Mo pour it, then he sipped a taste before he tossed it back. "You know those three fellas?"
"Yeah, I know them," Mo replied.
As they watched, one of the men went over and sat down at the table where the young woman and her son were eating.
"That big one that sat down with Emily is Ace Parker. I ain't surprised he'd make trouble. Doggone it, Jerry Stubbs was just in here a few minutes ago, too."
"So you're pretty sure Emily didn't invite him to join her?"
"I'm pretty sure of that," Mo said. "And I'm going to go see if I can do something about it."
"Looks to me like you're outnumbered," Bannock said. "Why don't you let me take care of Mr. Parker and you keep his two friends from shooting me in the back?"
"Mister, you got a deal, because I wasn't too confident of how I was going to do any good."
"All right," Bannock said. "I'm going to eat dinner." He left a coin on the bar and walked to the four tables in the back. As he approached the young lady's table, he heard her asking her uninvited guest to leave her and her son alone. Ace favored her with a devilish grin and declared, "I like a woman with a little bite in her. It's like breaking a bucking horse." He was surprised to see her looking up past him in alarm. He turned to see Bannock behind him, like a mighty oak tree that wasn't there a few seconds before.
"I'm sorry I'm a little late, Mrs. Green," Bannock said. "I stopped at the bar for a drink before we ate. Did you invite this fellow to join us for dinner?"
He waited to see if she realized he was trying to help, but she was still confused.
"I didn't invite anyone to join Peter and me, and I've just asked this man to leave us alone."
"That's what I figured," Bannock said before she had a chance to include him. "I told your daddy I wouldn't let you out of my sight till I brought you home. I hope you ain't going to tell him I stopped to have a drink."
He looked directly at Ace, who was speechless in his confusion.
"Glad I could stop you from making a big mistake, cowboy. You can go on back and join your friends now. No harm done."
"No harm done?" Ace's brain suddenly started working again, and he flared up. "Who the hell are you?"
"Now, don't let your mouth get you in trouble," Bannock scolded calmly. "I'm the fellow who was sent to look after Mrs. Green and her boy. My mistake for running a little late, Mrs. Green."
He glanced toward the kitchen door, then to see a woman standing in the doorway, stopped on her way out. Remembering the name mentioned by Mo, Bannock said, "I'll be eating dinner too, Pearl, and I'd like coffee with it." Back to Ace then, he asked, "Are you a little hard of hearing? If you are, I apologize. You can go back to your table now, and Pearl can fix you up with something to eat. Like I said, no harm done." Like Ace Parker, Emily Green was too confused to make sense of what was happening, but she gradually began to see that the stranger was acting on her behalf. Consequently, she remained silent while Ace got up from the chair. Standing tall, he found he still had to look up to cast a stare of defiance at the stranger.
"She should have said she was meeting somebody," was all Ace could think of to say before he went back to join his friends, who were waiting to hassle him about his attempted conquest.
When he left, Bannock sat down at the table with Emily.
"I hope you don't mind if I sit down with you, ma'am, but if I don't, I'm afraid he's going to know I was lying, and he might be back to bother you."
"No, mister, please join Peter and me for dinner," she said. "How did you know my name?"
"The bartender told me," Bannock answered.
He could see that she was still shaken from the encounter. She waited until Pearl placed his plate and coffee on the table before asking,
"Do you work for one of the ranches around here?"
No, ma'am, I'm just passing through town on my way west.
You're just passing through town and saw that I was having some trouble, so you decided to rescue Peter and me, she stated.
He shrugged as if anyone else would have done the same and took a sip of his coffee.
What is your name? She asked then.
John, he said, thinking it best not to tell her his last name, since he wasn't sure if anyone might come looking for him.
John what? She asked. What is your last name?
John Cochran, he replied at once, that being the only name that came to mind right away. It was his late mother's maiden name.
Well, John Cochran, I want to remember that name. I want to tell you how much I appreciate your stepping in to save Peter and me from what might have been something I would rather his 4-year-old eyes didn't see. Something like this has never happened to me before, and I've been in to eat here a couple times since Mr. Rainey made this little section into a cafe. Of course, my husband was with me before. He couldn't come today. He's the foreman at the Rockin' G Ranch, and they're moving a big part of the herd to some new grazing.
She reached over and playfully ruffled up her son's hair.
But today's Peter's birthday, and we promised him he could come into town and spend his birthday money. She smiled at her son. So that's what we did, isn't it, Peter? And we met a nice man in the process.
Then she stole a glance in the direction of the table where the three cowhands were sitting.
I'm afraid those three are going to cause you trouble, though. Did you know he had two friends when you came to help us?
Yeah, I knew, Bannock replied. But the bartender said he would watch my back if the other two started to get involved.
Mo Price? Emily responded.
I'm not sure you should put much faith in Mo's help if you really get in trouble. I'm sure he means well, but my husband Rex says Mo has a little control over what happens in this saloon.
Sounds like it might be a better idea if you waited next time till your husband could come with you again, he commented.
There's no doubt about that, she agreed. I don't think I'll ever even come to town again without my husband.
How far do you have to go to get home? He asked, and she said that it was 3.5 miles from town.
I think it might be a good idea if I rode along with you when you go back.
Oh, I couldn't ask you to do that, she protested, hoping with all her heart that he would.
I've already interrupted your trip more than enough.
No trouble at all, he told her. I'm not in a particular hurry to get where I'm going. So a few miles out of the way ain't going to make much difference, and it'd kind of set a little easier on my mind to see you get home safely. He paused. You and old man Peter there. She hesitated, wanting to tell him yes. What about if I do it as a favor for your husband, he suggested.
All right, she said. I know he would appreciate it.
Good, he responded. When will you be ready to go?
As soon as we finish eating, she answered.
That suited him. He had been glancing at the table where the three men were eating, and every time he did, he met Ace Parker's eyes concentrated on them. It was difficult to tell if Ace was zeroing on him or Emily. Either way, it meant trouble for him. They finished their dinner, and Emily went to the kitchen door to compliment Pearl on her chicken and dumplings and tried to pay for all three dinners, but Bannock insisted on paying for his. If I was a perfect gentleman, I'd pay for yours and Pete's, he told her.
If you were any more perfect, you might be sprouting a pair of wings, Emily said. My buggy's out back, so Peter and I will go out the back door. I assume your horse is tied in front of the saloon, so we'll meet you on the street.
Yes, ma'am, Bannock replied, and walked back through the saloon and said,
so long, DeMo, as he walked past the bar. Outside, he slipped his rifle back in the scabbard, untied his horses, and climbed aboard the buckskin. He wheeled away from the hitching rail and waited in the middle of the street for Emily to come from behind the saloon in her buggy. When she pulled out of the alley beside the saloon and headed north on the main street, Bannock pulled his horse up beside her. Behind them in the saloon, Ace Parker walked up to the front window and watched their departure. He went back to the table where Short and Scully were still eating.
I'm telling you, that lying dog weren't supposed to meet that woman here. He's riding a horse and leading a pack horse, and she had a buggy behind the saloon. He didn't come to town with her. The two of them just made a fool out of me.
Shoot, Ace, Short responded. When it comes to fools about women, you already have all the parts to make one. Don't take much for anybody to put them together to make a first-class fool, ain't that right, Scully?
Scully chuckled in response. I can't argue with that, and that fellow is bigger and uglier than you, Ace, and she still picked him.
He might have thought he was pretty smart, Ace responded, but he ain't seen the last of me. I don't stand for anybody trying to make a fool out of me.
Looks to me like he's already finished that little job, Short said, egging him on. He's done rode off with her, most likely seen her and her young and home.
That might have been his biggest mistake, Ace declared.
He might have been better off if he'd have just rode on his way and let her go on home by herself.
He stormed back to the bar to confront Mo Price.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?